This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Lee Scrivener. He's the author of a new book, Casino Labs, and I wrote a review of Casino Labs several months ago. But Lee, it's great having you on the show.
No, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And I'm also joined here with Matt Pegas.
Hey, Robert. Yeah, good to co-host. As always, it's been a while, and nice to meet you, Lee. I haven't read Casino Labs yet. I'll foreground that, but I'll be the kind of more
on some of the Vegas stuff later
For sure. And yeah, no, I do want to read it, and I'm curious to hear more about it today. Yeah.
So well, Matt, I don't know why you haven't read Casino Labs, because I read your book.
Really? Oh, well, thank you.
I'm just busting your balls. No, I just finished it a few days ago. I actually read both of you guys' books, and I enjoyed them both. So
thank you,
appreciate it. Yeah, no, I do as listeners to Robert's podcast, and I do New Right podcast, and we have our own little publishing outfit now. So I've been kind of most of what I've been reading has been toward that, but I'm going to amend reading Casino Labs as soon as possible, and I'm sure I'll get a good taste of it.
Yeah.
Did you read, this is a very egoic question, but I'll ask you, did you read Dragon Day or the Black Album?
Oh, yeah, I actually want to touch on that later, okay. But I think a good place to start would be...
Okay, that's
right. So, Lee, before we get to Casino Labs, do you want to give our audience a background... some background biographical information about yourself? You've written some satirical arts manifesto, and you've been a musician and a university lecturer.
Yeah, so I could talk for a long time about my biography, my background. So if I just kind of keep going, just
if you can shorten it into like three to five minutes.
A 300 word essay?
No.
Yeah. Yes. I have written a few things that have been published. So. I wrote a book like on insomnia, but I've always kind of dabbled in also in creative writing. In high school, I wrote a play. And so that was like probably my first, quote, success in writing. It was like a musical play, and I got my friends to like act and sing. And it was all very kind of silly. But it was such a, you know, it was such a fun experience that I was like, I've always had this need to do creative stuff, even though professionally I've kind of gone in more of a serious academic direction. But
were you a professor at the university in Las Vegas?
Yeah, actually, yeah, I was an adjunct professor at UNLV for many years. Mm. And actually that's one direction I could go in talking about kind of the origin of this novel, Casino Labs, because...
And you also had a show at the Tate.
Yeah, I've had some shows at like the Tate Modern and Tate Britain in London.
I've been there I was there in 2002.
Oh, cool. I was there in between 2005 and 2010, I guess. So, yeah, I lived in London for 5 years. It was actually... It's really cool. And, you know, the UK gets a lot of shit. Probably a lot of it is deserved. But I really enjoyed my time living in London. And I got the sense that, like, you know, as someone who's always kind of tried to do creative work, I never really had much traction or success doing writing until I moved to London, and then it just felt like the skids were greased for me, and everything I tried was like I was suddenly like on stage with Yoko Ono and like doing cool shit with like famous artists, and I'm like, how did this happen? It was really bizarre. So like I wrote this, my first kind of dabbling in like manifesto genre, like an arts manifesto. I wrote this thing called How to Write an Avant-Garde Manifesto, which it was just an idea I had about like kind of a fictionalized, rather than just talk about, you know, different manifestos from like the futurists or whatever, I fictionalized it and told a story about a guy who was tasked with writing avant-garde manifesto by his like his cohorts. And so he was going to write his avant-garde group's manifesto, and midway through he like spilled coffee over the manifesto and it ruined it, and so he had to like pilfer from all these other manifestos, like, you know, Fluxus or other kind of avant-garde collectives. And so because of that, I just kind of ended up talking about all these other kind of collective avant-garde groups. Anyway, I showed it to like one of my professors, and he happened to be like kind of a famous British author in his own right named Tom McCarthy, whose book Remainder won, like was shortlisted for the Booker Prize or something like that. And he's like, this is awesome. In about 3 weeks, there's going to be this manifesto marathon at the Serpentine Gallery. And like Marina Abramovich is going to be there and all these people on stage. I want you to join them and perform your manifesto on stage. And so I like shared a dressing room with Yoko Ono. And she was like, she kind of kicked our group out of her dressing room because like they were like, who are these ruffians? And my point is that when I was in England, when I was in London, I suddenly found like a feeling of success, like, oh, instead of just spinning my wheels or whatever, like some,
I mean,
of my
this
writing
could be
is,
a
is
whole,
being appreciated.
This could be like a whole tangent. But do you think it's true, the stereotype that Americans are more Philistines when it comes to like supporting the arts and culture? And especially, I mean, I think the other problem is that the left sort of, I mean, this might be too much of a tangent, but the left has a monopoly. But the other problem is there's also a streak of Philistinism, like on the right and just of American culture in general, that it's not valued as much. Is that a cliche? Or do you think there is validity to that argument?
Well, I think there's truth to that only in the sense that like, if you imagine your country as being like, if you draw a perimeter around your country and you just take like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and that's your country, then you're going to get kind of urban artist types are going to predominate, because, and my point is that England, like demographically, consists of just a bunch of big cities and a much, much, much smaller rural population relative to the United States, which has this vast, like, hinterlands of a population. So I think that's why America gets their reputation as being Philistine, is because their rurality just goes on and on and on forever. It's just so vast. Personally, I like, you know, I like that aspect of the United States. But I just think like when I got plopped into London, I just felt like you just meet a few people and they know everyone else in a particular artistic community. And suddenly you're rubbing shoulders with literally like 2 months after I did this manifesto marathon at the Serpentine Gallery, invited me to kind of talk at the British Library with Gustav Metzger, who was still alive back then. But he was like, you know, the auto-destructive artist, Gustav Metzger, who wrote these manifestos that kind of destroyed themselves or whatever. It was like me and him, and we were supposed to like have a debate. And here's this like 80, 90-year-old man. And I'm supposed, it was actually billed as like a slap in the face. This is going to be this rip roaring debate between this younger manifesto writer and a much older manifesto writer. And when I met him, he's like very affable and like this frail man. And I was like, I can't do this.
You grew up in Las Vegas. How much did that influence Casino Labs? And I can tell, I mean, I can actually tell by the way it's written that it was written by a local, by the geographic descriptions, like the detailed about certain streets. But would you also say, were you a group, so you were you a greeter like the protagonist in Casino Labs at Caesars? Morton,
I was
Morton's
gonna
his name.
get into that. So like it's funny because like when I grew up on this in the suburbs, and unlike a lot of my peers, like my parents actually didn't work in the casino industry. And so I felt slightly disconnected from the stereotypical like Las Vegas casino industry. My dad was a psychologist, which I think is,
Oh, like Dr. Nichols in the book.
like so it's slightly autobiographical for in the novel. Dr. Nichols is kind of a bit of my dad, but also Bill, the main character's father, is also a bit of my dad. So my dad's kind of a little, I mean, not to. It's not so autobiographical as that, but I think all writers kind of draw from their personal experiences and their autobiography to a certain extent. And so I just feel like the fact that there's a lot of psychology going on was probably something to do with the fact that I was raised by a psychologist or whatever.
Yeah. How did you end up in, or if it's not too personal or familial of a question, how did you end up? Because I think I saw you were born in Canada, but how did you, I always am curious with, I don't always ask these deep level autobiographical questions on interviews, but with Vegas in particular, I'm always curious sort of how people ended up there, if it's not too personal of a story.
Yeah, it's not too personal. Most of my like personal life has been discussed like publicly, so like I don't I don't shy away from it too much, but like
And I think you said you also lived in Moscow too.
yeah, so okay, I'll just go briefly. So
Ah,
like
fair.
both my parents both my, it's okay, both my parents are American, so like my dad's from Ohio, my mom's from Texas. And but late 60s, early 70s. I'm a bit older than you guys, I think. So
So Gen X.
I'm straight up Gen X. So my dad, I always suspected that he was trying to escape Vietnam, so that's why they moved to Canada. But he insists that he was offered a job teaching psychology at the University of Winnipeg, and he actually tells a story that like he was the draft office was like, "Why are you moving to Canada? You need to report to your nearest draft board." And so he drove across the border to show up to be drafted, and they're like, "Actually, you're too old." So they let him go. So he didn't get drafted. And but anyway, I happened to be born in Canada, and then about a year later, we moved back to the States. So
I
it's
think
just kind of an.
with Moscow, was that a job for the State Department for a cultural position?
So my wife's works for the State Department basically, and so I also work at the embassy in Moscow, but she's like the official FSO. But my oldest son was born in Istanbul, so it's just weird that like, I mean, my family's been in America for like 400 years,
Oh,
but since me like.
same with part of my family.
Yeah, so like, so it's just weird that I was not born in the United States, nor were, half my children. So it's just kind of odd. But yeah,
Interesting.
so anyway, so my dad, so a lot of our movings around is just as is the case with most people, just it has to do with getting jobs. So my dad, he moved to Philadelphia, worked there for a little bit as a psychologist, and then he was like, just got a job. We were going to move to Phoenix, and then my dad's like, "Oh no, I got a great offer from like the University Medical Clinic in Las Vegas, where he was going to be a crisis counselor." And so actually that might be a little bit more of what interested me in kind of deep
So, was being a
psychological
crisis counselor,
trauma.
I think a lot of it was a lot of it like gambling addiction, or despair
yeah industry. Like people yeah so as I've said in another interview that like told some stories that have been repeated a few times by my dad and by myself that you know like people would they'd freak out on drugs and they'd lose all their money and then they'd run around naked through the casino at 4 a.m. and the
wow.
police would take these people and bring them to my dad, and my dad would like psychologically evaluate them, make sure they weren't going to be harmed to themselves or others, maybe you know send them to a rehab center or something, or you know do something with them. And he was like the first line of defense. Once they brought him a guy who had plucked out his eyeball, and
oh God,
his eye was like hanging by its retinal strands in a cup of water, in like a Dixie cup. And he's like, well, why did you pluck out your eye? And the guy's like, well, I read a passage in the Bible that said, if your eye has seen sin, pluck it out, or something like that. And he took it literally. Gosh. So some of these stories, like I was a child kind of growing up with these kinds of stories. And I was like, wow, Vegas can be a crazy place. And so I knew that Vegas had a ton of stories like this. And so maybe that was something that kind of got me thinking in terms of writing a story about Vegas.
So the protagonist, Morton Waterhouse, he's LARPing as a Roman aristocrat, and it's kind of a cope for him being alienated from society. But that part of the humor in like his inner monologue, it reminds me of Confederacy of Dunces, but also of Spencer Grunhauer from Dan Baltic's Nutcracker.
Mm-hmm.
And his kind of relationship with society and how he kind of LARPs as this Roman aristocrat as a way to find, it's a way to find deeper meaning out of the society. Also, like, as far as like he feels a need that he's made an impact on history when he's in a world where things are pretty, pretty meaningless. And most people, they have a false conditioning by the media that they matter, but they really don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I kind of got that in, it's funny that, and I think we're going to probably, I think you intended to touch on some of this stuff that, you know, whether or not you can write like a explicitly political novel or whatever, but I think in couching some ideas just within the context of a character who has a particular perspective or a lack thereof is kind of enough. I think people that write really super explicit, political agenda.
Oh
novels,
yeah. Like right wing media generally fails because it's so explicit. The left has been more successful because they understand the more subtle nuances and intricacies of trying to use culture and something that's relatable, but almost like the politics, if it's successful, you subconsciously win people over. You're not blatant, like, this is how this is the team you're going to be on based on the character. And a lot of right-wing media, your book is obviously not that, but a lot of right-wing media is an utter failure, and it, especially if it brands itself as like right-wing media or art.
Yeah, I think other people can brand my book as kind of right wing or whatever. I didn't obviously set out to write explicitly kind of quote unquote right wing book, but I think we live in a culture where everything is going to be in that way, unless it's like explicitly about, you know, like if, I mean, if you don't tick the boxes of like the normal concerns. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of people have problems when they're approaching agents. Because when I started approaching agents, like right away, it's like you feel like you're being filtered out because you're not writing about, you know, transgenderism or some of these pet concerns. And I always thought that was kind of a shame because, like, in the grand scheme of things, like, that's very limiting to what an author is going to be concerned with and write about and tell their story about. It would be like if I said, well, I'm an agent, I only want you to send me stories about pancakes, or you know, like something very narrow that's really arbitrary. And I'm like, well, why? My story's not about pancakes. Can I send it to you anyway? Because it's actually about, hot dogs or,
It
not to
was
make
reviewed in the Las
it.
Vegas Journal. I'm trying to think, what is the TV series that the Vegas Journal compared it to? Severance?
Severance,
Oh, the
right?
Las
Yeah.
Vegas Review, the Las Vegas Review
Las Vegas
Journal.
Review Journal.
Oh yeah. Severance, I think. Yeah, I actually only
Interesting
saw
comp, yeah.
half. Yeah, I
I don't
saw
think
like one
I, to be
episode.
honest, I haven't actually, well, I haven't watched
I
that.
have. I like it. Not to go on a tangent about it, I think it's good. I'm
Yeah.
curious. There's the Las Vegas Review Journal was comparing it to like the way that it explores work culture, right? Or like the modern
Oh, yeah.
bifurcation
No, I see
thereof or
that.
something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
I only saw one episode of Severance, but I did notice. Yeah, it's like when you enter this work environment, you're surrounded by, the kind of mystery box oddities of like, well, what could this be? And there's definitely that in my book. But I was going
But
to
from
say,
like a
like,
casino perspective, interesting. Yeah, go on, sorry.
For like, actually, not even so much the casino, but like later, he Morton, the main character Morton, joins an architectural firm to build casinos, and
Yeah.
that's when things get kind of really hairy. But I was going to say, like, there's a definitely a parallel between, like, you guys, to be specific, you guys. I'm mainly talking about Vaporfornia, which I read, and
Right.
Dragon Day. Yeah,
Oh,
and I
so
think
like you
that.
mean kind of like how the protagonist Max in Vaporfornia, he's taken by the secret, they have kind of almost like a ball to be on the Hollywood show, sort of like that.
I mean, there's elements of that, but even in the main characters themselves, like they are, and actually, I did start reading Nutcracker by Dan Baltic.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? Maybe halfway through that, maybe not.
Yeah.
But his main character, Spencer, whatever. I think they're all, men, young men who, and I don't really play so much into the kind of incel culture thing.
Right. Because I don't think the thing is,
I do think like the incel theme is very kind of the current, maybe the current zeitgeist, because it's a different era. Takes place in the 90s. I think with your character, like Morden, he feels disconnected from society, but he doesn't fit the like the angry incel archetype. Like he doesn't go on a rant like I'm angry because I'm not getting laid or getting status or even making enough money. It's more of a crisis where he finds a lack of meaning out of society.
Yeah, and that just might be by virtue of the fact that I am kind of Gen X, and so I don't, I mean, I remember when the incel thing really blew up right around maybe 2015 or whatever. I almost wanted to take, and again, it's like a generational thing. I think you guys are millennials or maybe late zoomers. I don't know what you guys are, but
Millennials,
you
I
were
guess,
both
yeah.
millennials. Okay. So like, and I don't, obviously I don't know you guys. I don't know your personal lives or anything, but I always wanted to take, like when I hear of millennials who have, like, and again, I'm not making any insinuation about you personally, but like incel status, like I always want to take these people aside and be like, like give them a big hug and be like, it's not so bad. It's not so hard, but maybe it is hard. I mean, I realize that things have changed with social media and Tinder and all these things that it
But at
makes
the
it very
same
difficult.
time in your book,
Whereas it
you
might make
do.
it easier in a sense. I don't know.
Like your but the thing is, your book does hint at like atomization.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That's kind of I mean, I feel like atomization is kind of a generic or more general incel-ness that's not purely sexual. It's just it's like a shoe that
Yeah.
fits everyone.
No, that's a really interesting distinction because I think I was born in the 90s. I don't remember it that well, but my impression, even just reading books by Gen Xers, and I'm sure Casino Labs will join that list soon. And like there's like a less than I've actually been thinking with regard to what I do with publishing and everything and manuscripts I've gotten. The incel narrative has gotten, I wouldn't say it's gotten played out because I like it. I like the kind of Welbeck, whatever model, but it's interesting, you know, 7 to 10 years ago, I'd have conversations with people about how like this topic of incels and the things men go through today has really not been touched in literature. And at the time that was true, it's gotten a lot more common now.
But I was out in public and I saw a couple, kind of like they would have been called, like the incels would call them, they're both blonde, like Chad and Stacy, and they were in their maybe like later teens. And I heard one of them say the word mog. Like the terminology, it's like totally normal, mainstream.
The terminology has gone mainstream, and a lot of it is sort of in our corner of Twitter. But some of these books are getting bigger than they had been previously. You know, they're getting some mainstream. Maybe a little bit of a stretch to say mainstream attention, but you know, they're getting noticed by people like Ross Bark and others. And that incel theme does come to light. And anyway, I'm trying to weave together a theme here, and I won't be too verbose here. But basically, there's kind of like a less than zero Gen X sort of outside, maybe less than zero isn't the best example, but like sort of outsider protagonist.
Well, I guess like the way what I would describe like less than zero and the more Gen Xer cliche is that they're successful in like attaining hedonistic pleasures, but it's a crisis of emptiness and a spiritual void.
I think a lot of nihilism would be like, oh, I at least they got to experience something. But I think as
like,
history
that's what
marches
I get from
on,
Brady Sinelis.
Definitely Bret Easton Ellis, but as literary culture marches on, I feel like those two themes are sort of coming, like converging a little bit, maybe, or that they could, where it's like, yes, there's people in today's age who are just completely atomized and isolated sexually and otherwise. And then, you know, previously, maybe there's people who are more outsiders, and, you know, there's stark generational differences, but at the same time, maybe some of the themes are at core the same, which is noticing a kind of fundamental nihilism behind things.
Yeah, for sure. I think my novel is like, it takes that theme of atomization and kind of stretches it out through time. And I think Morton Waterhouse is like, you do meet him at a moment where he doesn't explicitly have a girlfriend, but the idea of him having a girlfriend is not so much beyond a realm of possibility.
Right,
like
right,
he,
right.
he meets people that he could easily that, or that, you know, maybe eventually does have relationships with. And he's mainly focused on kind of a grievance that he has with his dad and how that's kind of keeping him from.
So like a big theme is like the importance of family and like a cultural inheritance from one's lineage, which is all obviously also a critique of atomization.
Yeah.
Right, right. Like, actually, another thing is, what's that thing? Is it the Bechdel test where you don't see a woman and another woman having a meaningful relationship? Or
conversation about something other than a man, or something, yeah.
Is that what I'm talking about?
I believe
the right term?
So, yeah, Bechdel test, yeah.
But I don't think my novel necessarily would pass it, but it's not necessarily a misogynistic novel because there are some female characters who are quite heroic in some ways. And even though there's a kind of a tension between Morton and his sister, not a sexual tension, like a sibling rivalry tension.
It does seem that his sister looks,
it's never
she
clear
does
who,
look down
who,
on him
never,
and she views him as kind of an embarrassment.
Yeah, but it's never quite clear who's right and who's wrong in that analysis. Like, should we side with Morton's perspective or should we side with Scarlett's perspective? And they kind of debate as to whether or not their father, who has this mental condition, which is kind of like Munchausen syndrome or hypochondria, like he thinks he's obsessed with the fact that he saw like a nuclear test decades ago and that his brain has been fried by this nuclear test, and so every problem in his life he'll blame on the fact, like, you know, he forgets his wedding anniversary with his wife and he's like, oh, that it's the nuclear bomb that made me so airheady, like that cut me some slack here, you didn't see a nuke like I did. And so, but Morton's like, oh, that's just like a get out of jail free card, like it's not real. Whereas Scarlett's like, no, he really did suffer for this, you know. So that's kind of the first like contention in the novel, and this idea of like, when Bill Morton's dad, who saw the nuke, he gets his brain erased basically by this nuke, allegedly. And I think there's a parallel between this idea of how the casino industry basically takes, or especially in the 80s and 90s when they were building, like, or 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s when they were building these like themes that were informed by like historical civilizations and artifacts. Like, so Caesar's Palace was kind of an homage to ancient Rome. And so Casino Labs, as this, in the novel, Casino Labs is an architecture firm that builds casinos and deconstructs like historical, just deconstructs ancient Rome and turns it into a Las Vegas casino. And I think that kind of deconstruction of historical memory and civilizational inheritance has a parallel with Bill Waterhouse, who has his brain basically fried. And those two things end up being kind of connected anyway. So,
and then it's also kind of a conspiracy theory angle. And I like how that's open-ended, because it's not like you can read it, you can be a conspiracy theorist or you can be a skeptic and enjoy it. It's not like in your face about that, but it's open-ended. I think that's successful too. But it does link to kind of stuff like Area 52 and Cold War military experiments.
Yeah, yeah. And again, those things don't really arise until later. Like, I think I kind of wanted the novel to be fairly like mundane at first, so that you know this could happen to anyone anywhere. And it is a little bit weird even at first, but like it gets progressively weirder.
So like you didn't go like full into surrealism or the genre of magical realism like a David Lynch film or William S. Burroughs. So you sort of start it in mundane, it's fairly mundane, and then certain parts, like, not to give too many spoilers, but when he's exploring that labyrinth underneath Casino Labs, like, that veers into more magical realism, but most of it feels like he's in reality. It's only specific parts.
Yeah, I think that was kind of like a dramatic choice or something like that. Like, I feel like a lot of movies, a lot of movies have been very successful in having like a magical realist element where like things get really surreal and crazy. Like, I'm thinking Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind or something.
Right. Yeah.
Where
yeah.
you have a world where you're like following your own dream or memory world as it gets erased or something like that. And my novel has to do with similar concerns of erasing memory, but I feel like a lot of films take those kinds of things too far, in the sense that, like, a lot of Cape shit, like, you don't know how far physics, the laws of physics, have been suspended in this world, so that like you can just kind of I don't know,
they don't define like their terms well. Yeah.
Or like, even like, I don't know, just like there's this what's that new like Lord of the Rings series, Rings of Power. Have you guys seen
that? The Amazon one, right? No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's like an Amazon one. It's so terrible, and it's like everything is just, oh, okay. You know, the main character needs to escape a burning city. Oh, she went through a secret dwarf tunnel that just appears.
Yeah.
And doesn't get explained. And it's just a convenience that the showrunners are like, oh, well, we need to get her out of the city. Oh, I know. We'll just give her a secret dwarf tunnel.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
I'm trying to think of another good example. Like, there's so many. But yeah, I know, like, where they just
does the labyrinth remind you of some of the labyrinths in Vaporfornia? Because I was actually thinking of that, even though it's just a pure coincidence.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's a lot of I can't remember whether it was your book or I think it was you mentioned I don't know if you mentioned the back rooms, but you described.
I don't use the word
back
rooms, but it's like the back rooms, and like the back rooms. I think it has like a metaphysical component, like either like the astral plane or just the subconscious.
But you're talking about Robert in your book of the Beverly experience, right?
Oh, that too. Yeah.
Yeah, but I guess anyway, go on. Sorry.
Like it feels like it's sort of like you're going for the back rooms while also having an acid trip.
Yeah, so anyway, it's kind of like that. And just to answer your question maybe a little bit more, is that like I just wanted things to be fairly mundane to give the reader a sense like this world is totally recognizable, totally believable, totally real, as if it's like, okay, these are stepping stones leading into this swamp, but the stepping stones themselves are solid. But as you get deeper into the swamp, they start to become less solid, and the logic of what you can trust as being real and the laws of physics or whatever, like that takes you deep into the story. I feel like if things weren't solid initially, then it would be like, well, what to trust? What can I actually sink my teeth into?
Vaporfornia, I do that as well. It starts out in reality and then veers kind of back and forth. Mm. I think that's more, but I guess some books like William S. Burroughs, like that's like pure surrealism from the start.
Yeah. Right. I read a great book that was like one of the, like I've read in my academic career, I'm mainly reading like 19th century works. But I have read some modern fiction, and one of the main ones I've read in the last, I don't know, decade or so was Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections.
Yeah.
And I loved how that was so kind of mundane, like almost overly mundane, like, you know, Chip is like, that's another thing that all our novels kind of have in common is like just like that kind of college story. I mean, I guess Vaporfornia, he never actually goes to college, but he's of college age.
He briefly goes to City College.
Yeah.
Right.
And Chip is like a grad.
Yeah, right.
Chip in The Corrections is like a grad student or a young professor or something.
It's been a while, but I have read it.
And so is Morton Waterhouse. Anyway, but I just like how, you know, there's like this very kind of earthy, mundane, like, oh, this is a family drama. There is no magical realism. The sentiments are just the kinds that you would recognize among your own family. And maybe I'm just copying off that a bit, but I just kind of wanted it to be that. And when it gets weirder at the end, I just felt like, you know, that was just the Ames room I was going into. Like,
do you think,
but everything else was kind of just solid and mundane at first. I don't know.
Is there a philosophical question of destiny versus random coincidences?
What do you mean?
With how things play out in the plot and the ending.
Yeah, I don't know. Like the difference between coincidence and fate or destiny.
Yeah.
I think any good novel is going to feel like it can't seem too random. But it can't seem too like destined either. Like there has to be a sense of randomness. Because it's a tight knit community inside the novel, like these people know each other. They're related in a lot of cases. There can't be too many untied or loose ends. That has to tie itself up some way because these people are like a family or whatever. And even things specifically in the novel, things that seem random, like a coincidence, for instance, and I'll give this minor thing away, you know, spoiler alert or whatever, but like Morton's father meets a Russian woman named Sveva, who you begin to suspect might be a spy,
isn't she also the cousin of his roommate?
Right. And then, so when it turns out that she happens to be this girl that's like dating this much younger girl that's dating his like 60-year-old dad happens to be the cousin of Morton's roommate. And they're like, what are the odds, you know? And then it's like, oh, well, the odds are quite, they're not such long odds if you realize these people are actually working for the intelligence services or whatever. And then it becomes explained like, oh, okay, I see why these people have come to us. And it's not just random, like this happened because of reasons, you know? But.
I want to get like more into like Vegas itself, which the
Oh,
book,
yeah.
which is a crucial part of the book. So like in Vegas, I think it's everything is temporary. So there's this the appeal of vintage Vegas nostalgia, like for what is lost. And now we're kind of seeing like things that were maybe in your time, like the Mirage was were considered relatively new for your generation. That was like the first, like the Mirage is significant because it's the first wave of the big themed resorts, and now that was recently destroyed to build for a Hard Rock Casino. And like how Vegas, the thing is like how Vegas epitomizes postmodernism, you know, it takes aesthetics of the past to create something that's more part of like commercialism and serves like an economic purpose. But I think what's important about that is some like more traditionalists are just going to outright reject that. But instead of rejecting that, you can find meaning out of that, and I think Morton does find meaning out of that because he thinks of like Caesar's Palace as like a Roman temple. He doesn't outright reject it like a reactionary does, and I think that's something that I've been doing with a lot of my work, from like my art to my fiction, and both my fiction and nonfiction writing has been a major theme.
I think it's just weird that the Mirage has been already destroyed. It being it was built I think in 89 or
Right.
88
Yeah,
or
really not that
89.
long of a tenure. Yeah.
Whereas just next door is Caesar's Palace, which was actually an earlier, there were some themed casinos that preceded the Mirage,
I
so
think
Caesar's Palace being.
Caesar's Palace is older, but they rebuilt most of it, so I'm not sure how much of the existing architectural side is original. I think most of it dates from the 90s, but there may be like a small part of it, like maybe some statues left from the original.
It's been added to a lot, but the main building of Caesar's Palace is it still exists, but it the facade used to be there's a architectural term for like this brick, like see-through bricks,
Oh,
like
right. Like glass
latticework
bricks.
bricks. It's lattice bricks. There's another technical term for it, but anyway, the building's the same, the main building as you walk in through the, into reception, where the famous fountain that Evel Knievel jumped over. That's the main entrance, and it's still the main entrance. But they just added to it, so they've been adding to it since the '60s. It was built in '66. And the Aladdin, I think, might have preceded it by a year. Both of those were like the first kind of weirdly themed casinos. But you're right that in the sense that the Mirage was like the first super casino of its of the kind of later '90s boom of like Vegas was just the fastest growing city in America all through the '90s. And they just kept building these enormous casinos, and the Mirage was the first of that group. It was succeeded immediately by the Excalibur, and then like the Luxor. It's interesting because like that was kind of like. I actually didn't live in Vegas during the '90s. I lived there in the '80s as a kid, basically. But when I moved back to Vegas after college, I was working as an English professor at UNLV, and I was dating a girl at the time who worked at the reception desk at Caesars, and During summer, because I was just an adjunct, I didn't have tenure. I was like, I needed money during the summer. I needed to have an income during the summer. So my girlfriend's like, well, I was just talking to my boss today, and he said we need someone to like, not a greeter actually. I was the guy that like started the moving walkways when they broke down. So they had moving walkways in Caesars, kind of to suck in tourists from the strip. And sometimes they broke down because of the heat or whatever. And I'm like, well, I don't know how to restart a moving walkway. I'm not like an engineer. And she's like, no, you just have this little golden key that you stick in the moving walkway and you restart it when it breaks down. It just restarts. And I was like, fuck, I could do that.
That's the
That's
job,
easy.
yeah.
And so I spent like that summer wandering around Caesar's Palace. Unfortunately, I was actually not dressed as Caesar, like Morton Waterhouse, the main character of this novel. But there were these Caesars that would walk around occasionally, and you'd see Cleopatra, you'd see Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, whatever. And I was like, man, I wish I were one of those guys. Those guys are cool. But I just had like cargo shorts or whatever. But anyway, I'd just be walking around Caesar's Palace all day. And I think that's when I started thinking, like, oh, would make a cool story of a guy who works at Caesar's Palace and he gets obsessed with Rome. And he starts to, the distinction between
Because
stupid, like
yeah, I
Los.
think the thing is like we don't have, like, we've severed our ties from tradition. So like our purpose now is to find meaning out of like what we have, and postmodernism I think is one of them. But I think the what's kind of sad is like that stuff. Like, well, the other thing is like the 80s malls getting the minimalist renovations, and now malls are pretty dead. But like
Right.
postmodernism was replaced by these more minimalist projects. Like the Aria City Center complex, which could be almost anywhere in the world or the country, or kind of like how neon got replaced by these like really bland like LED screens.
I almost have a theory about that, if you'll indulge me. No,
For sure.
I know, well, I mean, and I don't know, there's probably nothing to this, but like I've noticed that too. Like the most recent Vegas casinos, like the Cosmopolitan, the Aria, are modernist without the decoration of theme. They're not ornamented. They're just kind of like aesthetically modernist. And I almost feel like there's something a little bit cringe now, or maybe not cringe, just like too much information about a theme that has a historical time and place behind it. Like, oh, this is an homage to ancient Rome, or this is like the Venetian, or the Excalibur. Oh, this is King Arthur's court in miniature. And I feel like a casino doesn't want to invest in one experience, like welcome to King Arthur's court, welcome to the Luxor. You're in ancient Egypt.
So it's
Like,
almost like the late stage capitalism theory.
yeah, it's like we need to appeal to everyone. We can't just appeal. And the other thing is, like, I mean, I feel like if you were in the 1960s, people used to study, like, your average person, I feel like, knew more about stories of King Arthur, stories of ancient Rome, Etude Brute. And they knew those more because those were taught in school, those were taught in college, those were taught in high school. Now, like, a lot of that stuff has been kind of shunted aside for kind of feel good, like bromide topics of like, inclusivity or whatever. And you don't want to latch on to, like, hey, we have a cultural inheritance here that we need to keep, that we need to sustain and maintain. And so, like, they're a little bit like, this is not what we do anymore. We're into like this nothing.
No, I think there's a lot
Were
of
you gonna
truth
say,
to that.
Matt?
No, sorry for interrupting. No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think in terms of our own cultural inheritance being less emphasized in schools, et cetera. I mean, I think there's several things in what you said that are true. I think it's a decline in that. I think there is something deep-seated about the sort of economics of it, where it's like we don't want to get locked into one thing. It's almost seen as corny. People want to have places where, there's just some more narcissism to it or something, where it's like they don't want the theme to be imposed upon them. They want like just a pleasing backdrop for, I mean, this is going to sound very boomery, but but there's some truth to it. I think, just a pleasing backdrop for social media type stuff, which I don't know if King Arthur is that anymore, or even the Luxor is that anymore. It's more so just like, you know, some nice lights or something. And the newest one, I
It's
guess, is the
or more
Morning Blue.
metaphysically, it's a homogenization of the collective subconscious.
Yeah, that's a really good
I
way
mean,
of
I
putting
think
it, I
the
think. Yeah.
it's like the apotheosis of this tendency. What we're talking about here is, I don't know if you've seen the sphere. The sphere.
Oh
It's
yeah,
like
I
this
know. From the outside, yeah.
Some people are blown away by it.
from the.
I don't really care about it.
Well, what I'm saying is, like, it's just a sphere, and it projects. It can always be updated with a new projection. Like, it doesn't have any
That's interesting.
baggage that's supposed to be lasting. It is like a cell phone in the shape of a
Oh yeah.
sphere, and what's kind of projected on its surface can always be changed. So
That's
it
really
isn't
insightful.
any,
Yeah.
yeah, it's like it's not any like non-ephemeral thing. It's always constantly being
It's like
rep
an, I don't
Right, which is what
I mean
people
I
want, yeah.
Matt might disagree.
With,
I don't
yeah.
really care for it because it makes me think of like a giant computer screen, which when I'm traveling, I want to kind of get away from that mundane. I think another
Yeah.
angle is like Vegas. It's sort of like alchemy and how it manipulates the subconscious because like reality is consciousness and it shifts your conscious. So when you go to Vegas, you're going for this otherworldly experience
Sure.
of consciousness.
Yeah. No, I think that's accurate.
And a
Yeah.
few people, go
Go on.
ahead.
Go on. You know, you first.
No, please, please.
Was just going to, this is maybe going back half a step, but no, I was just going to agree largely on this here. Robert was like, Matt might disagree because I've always expressed an interest in going in. I mean, I will sometimes defend the sphere, but without disagreeing with what you just said, I think the interesting about the sphere is that it's kind of the most aesthetically maximal version of this cell phone aesthetic, and at least it gets the maximalist part right, is all I'd say. But also your diagnosis of what it is, I think, is very insightful and true. And I would
Yeah,
take,
I've
you
actually
know,
never
older
been in
Vegas
the
over it.
sphere
Yeah.
either. It's speaking as a long-term Vegas person, I haven't been in just 'cause I'm not like I don't live full-time in Vegas. I visit on occasion, and you know, I've got like four kids now, so to get us all into the
I
sphere is like a
think we
thousand
may have been
dollars.
there the same weekend, but we missed each other.
Yeah, I think we did. Like I was there last summer, but yeah, it's just apparently a very expensive thing to do, as is a
Yeah.
lot of Vegas entertainment. You know, it used to be like Vegas, one of its selling points was that it was just cheap and you could go there. I mean, apart from gambling, you
Or it was
could,
like
I mean, that was open-ended.
the mantra of that stage of capitalism was that every man could live like a king.
Right.
Certainly
And
in
then you can
Vegas.
go.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but they made the entertainment aspect very cheap, and the food, and like I remember, like, oh, 99% or 99 cent breakfast buffet at XYZ Casino or whatever, just to get you in the door, and the beers were super cheap, and the idea was like if you were happy and drinking and well fed, you would just stay a while and gamble, and I don't think that's really the case anymore. Now you actually have to pay to park, which was unheard of back
And
in
now,
the
yeah,
day.
like now
So I mean,
Vegas.
the experience is a lot more expensive, and
Yeah.
I that's why it's actually dying. Is like a lot of people are like, oh, I can barely manage to
Yeah, if
meet
you're
my
going to
budget
spend
as it
money, I
is.
don't know if Vegas is going to be your top choice for
It
most
seemed
people.
busy when we were here, but there's all this hype of Vegas being in decline, whether it's a recessionary symbol or Zoomers not being interested in gambling. But despite all the hype of Vegas in decline, when we were there this summer, it felt relatively busy.
Relatively, yeah.
But
Yeah, one of
maybe
my,
less so than in the past.
yeah.
one of my best friends works at the Bellagio, and he's like a fourth or third generation Las Vegan, whereas my family moved there when I was about seven. But he's been there forever, and his family all works in casinos, and you know, he says that it has slowed down, which I think is inevitable. I mean, things go in peaks and valleys. But yeah, I think there is, I don't know, maybe the sell, and I think just like movies, it's kind of fighting the entertainment draw of just sitting around and doing Netflix and boxed wine and looking at your cell phone all day. You know, a lot of, and you can gamble on your phone too. So a
Right.
lot of what Vegas offers can be can be gotten in your living room or your bedroom anytime, 24/7.
Especially with like VR,
you don't
VR
have to buy
in
a
the
plane
future.
Ticket. Yeah.
I guess one other thing to touch on is like these minimalist renovations that are woke. I wrote about that a couple years ago with the Hollywood and Highland Mall, where they gave it a minimalist renovation where they got rid of postmodernism, but it was framed as woke because of the statues were from D.W. Griffith's film Intolerance. And I've been thinking about that for quite some time, but I noticed like normie conservatives, like I didn't even bother writing about this because I felt it was too cliche, but normie conservatives picked this up with like Cracker Barrel, where it's not like the minimalist renovations, they're done for political reasons of erasing the past. But I think you touch on that in Casino Labs, where the Casino Lab firms are talking about certain statues or artistic images that are problematic at Caesar's Palace. Or it's called something else, but the place that depicts Caesar's Palace.
Right, yeah. I call it like Caesar's Empire or
right.
something like that. I think that's some of the places like that are where I get my most explicitly political. And, you know, I feel like some of these discussions could have taken place in like a graduate seminar, or they probably did take place in a graduate seminar that I attended on art or something, where it's like, oh, this statue or this painting is very problematic because like, look at the man, he looks very domineering, or, you know, whatever. And that becomes a critique of art. And so when Casino Labs as an architectural firm, one of the points of Casino Labs' kind of raison d'etre in the novel is that they are to go in, they're supposed to go into your casino and update it and make it, I hate this term, but like make it woke or whatever. They take away all the problematic bits of your casino and they modernize it. They take away, like, an example is like right outside of the main valet of Caesar's Palace or Caesar's Empire, you have the Rape of the Sabbath,
oh, right.
The Rape of the Sabines by Gian Bologna, which is basically just a guy raping women.
So they got rid of that in reality? I think
I don't think they actually got rid of it in reality. But
so
in
I think some other examples is Pirates of the Caribbean and Splash Mountain did something similar at Disneyland. And then also I wrote about one article I touched on, the Sir Francis Drake Hotel in San Francisco. Since Sir Francis Drake was problematic as a slaveholder or a slave trader, they took down, like they had this hotel in Union Square in San Francisco where it was a Edwardian or Elizabethan English theme. And they renovated it by getting rid of the Sir Francis Drake theme to be more minimalistic. So there's actually countless examples of this. I think the Cracker Barrel one was the most cliche example that like the mainstream right picked up on.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I wrote some of those scenes not too around the time of the, you know, the BLM riots where all these Civil War memorials were being destroyed or whatever. And again, like that's kind of the most overtly political the novel gets. I mean, overtly political. I think there's always a subtext of some political ideas. But this idea that these statues need to go because they're just not modern enough and they're an homage to a problematic past or whatever. So Casino Labs as a architectural firm, they kind of erase memory, inheritance, culture, or deconstruct it. And in that way, other people have said this, that it's kind of informed by Baudrillard. And, you know, he has that theory of the simulacrum. And I think a lot of people actually, I think some people get this wrong in the sense that, like, there's like the third order of simulacrum, where, you know, the first is just a simulation. You draw a picture of something. And then there's the second stage, a picture of a picture. And then the third stage is like, you get so far removed from the original that it just becomes a meme, a perpetuating meme or simulation devoid of the original content. So you could say, oh, well, Caesar's Palace is this like a Baudrillardian simulation or simulacrum where it doesn't have any relevance, or there's nothing, ancient Rome is like a real place with like mythology and culture, and it's smelly and
So
there's.
the question is, like, do we find meaning out of it before all of these postmodernist projects that do have charm are kind of are erased and replaced by something that is totally meaningless, like the minimalism? Though actually, to be slightly more optimistic, I have noticed, like, I think 2010s was peak minimalism, but I noticed this decade there has been somewhat of a more homage. It's not like this, the new stuff now in this decade, the 2020s, is not, I mean, it's not the best, as good as the past, but it's a slight improvement over the 2010s, where there is some return to retro, like that new casino in Fremont Street downtown. I forget, it's a high rise, I forget the name, but there's a new high rise casino downtown that does look a bit more retro. So there, I think, like, this decade is slightly a slight improvement over the 2010s.
No, I'm really
Interesting.
fascinated. And even by speaking of Vapornia, I'm interested in that vaporwave aesthetic, which is a throwback to. Vaporwave being like you take, your 8-bit graphics plus Gothic or Corinthian column from ancient Rome or whatever. My novel kind of preceded that retroactive or retrospective of the vaporwave era in the 2010s or whatever. But I still felt like it. I recognize that as cool and relevant to my novel as well. So,
We also, on our last trip, we got to visit Mount Charleston for the first time.
oh yeah, no, I love Mount Charleston. I mean, one of my fr and I, in fact, I think a lot of people say they see that I grew up in Vegas, and but I'm not like a Vegas guy. Because I don't know, like on some level, the overstimulation of Vegas actually drove me towards asceticism. Like it made me actually have much more of an appreciation to for like the void of empty night and
Or it's
for
kind of like this
living out in the
contrast.
desert where there was none of that overstimulation.
Like, I wrote an article about this, like the contrast of, like, the overstimulation of Vegas and then going up to Mount Charleston, where it's cooler weather and more serene, more meditative. So yeah, like,
Oh, yeah.
maybe as I'm getting older, I'm turning more to asceticism, but I do sort of, I'm really fascinated with the experience of consciousness, and like I'm reading been well this book called by Colin Wilson, The Outsider. But I know, like, Colin Wilson, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he's known for writing about consciousness and shifts in consciousness and how kind of the intensity of consciousness complements each other. They make one more, like, there, I guess there's are people who turn to, like, a pure asceticism, but sometimes when you visit places that are extremely different, like hyper-urbanism, like I went to New York for the first time in my life in June, and going to somewhere more remote in nature, like the contrast of that heightens consciousness and its escape from the mundane.
Right, and the only 2 cents I'd add is arguably Vegas. I mean, there's some similarities with sort of Southern California, the Southwest writ large, Phoenix, but Vegas especially is where that contrast is the most stark. I mean, you literally are on the Strip, and then you're not quite in Mount Charleston, but like on the way there within minutes. It's like it's. There's the Strip and all its stimulus, and then there's the desert, and there's very little buffer. I mean, there's a bit of a sprawl, but you know what I mean. Like
Oh
you can
yeah,
kind of
no,
experiment with that
especially
quite
because,
starkly there.
I mean, speaking of Southern California, especially because I think it's Del Webb. Was that the name of the company that built Newport or Irvine?
Oh, right. The
UC
mall?
Irvine?
Or no.
No,
Maybe the Irvine Ranch Company?
UC Irvine. I think it's the Del Webb Corporation built UC Irvine. I think that's the name, but they also built Summerlin, which is like a master plan neighborhood in Vegas. But the idea is that like a lot of those communities around Vegas were built by these as master plan communities by these huge corporations that just, bought up a huge plot of land and developed it as a as like kind of a master plan community, as a very artificial, like, hey, we're gonna build Summerlin, which is like it's we're gonna give it its own little Main Street, and we're gonna build this will be the central square of this community. But it was all built like overnight. And I mean one a lot of people who visit from Europe, they come to Vegas and they're like, I don't understand. Where's the town square? Where's like the center of this place? And there's something about Vegas that, because it was built artificially by people with lots of money growing up, going out and built, buying up very cheap land and then kind of creating it suddenly in mass. So the effects of that is that you have a very built up section where you have very dense housing or very dense houses. And then across the street is a vast empty desert that stretches on into the Mojave and into Death Valley. And it just ends. There's no normal, like there is sprawl in some areas, but a lot of Vegas is just surrounded by like a very starkly drawn line between this is the part that's been kind of extracted out of nature and been brought to the 21st century architecturally. And this other stuff out here is just wasteland.
Yeah,
And
no,
so
it's
you could
really.
take one step into the wasteland and suddenly all the trappings of civilization just immediately disappear and you're out among the like lizards.
Yeah, there's nowhere
And
else on Earth that I've been that's quite like it, you know?
yeah, I mean it kind of reminds me of Dubai in that sense.
I was
Like
gonna
you
say,
got this,
Dubai. Yeah.
yeah, you got this just empty, inhospitable desert and then the most over the top like architectural thing you've ever seen. It's very, yeah, but
Yeah, no. I've always thought of that. My other book, The Black Album, has an essay on Vegas, which somewhat relevant to some of it. I'll send. Don't even bother reading the whole book. I can just send you that. But anyway, not even to stuff. I think there's a section in it, and this reflects my continual experience of going to Vegas, where I love Vegas. I really do. I can experience multiple levels of this stuff, and the shifts of consciousness, as Robert said, and have it all be positive. But sometimes you're there, and it's a little overwhelming, the various scents and sounds, and just the I mean I'll gamble a little bit, even though I'm not a big gambler, and that has its ups and downs. And I'm always just struck, yeah, seeing looking out at the blue sky and Mount Charleston and the Red Rock, like quite literally just that you can see that natural placidity from the Strip has just
Yeah,
always
so I think Vegas,
like very literally has always struck me,
it's part of Vegas is people deride Vegas for being man-made and being devoid of history and charm, but that's not true, because the a lot of what makes Vegas great is the beautiful natural setting. And
Totally.
I think I do remember the fir my first trip to Vegas. I think it was 2009. Like it was seeing it for the first time, even like hitting Prim for the first time, which is that's actually going away now. But it
I
was
hear
really,
you.
I
Yeah.
remember like the first time driving in was a really otherworldly experience. Kind of like seeing New York for the first time was an otherworldly experience, which maybe is a cheesy thing, kind of tourist-like thing to say, but it is like a real shift in the in consciousness, like seeing a place you've seen in media. But I kind of regret like not being able to go to Vegas as a kid in the 90s. Like I didn't, for some reason, like my family were in SoCal, but we didn't travel to Vegas early on. But I guess I do have some regret for not being able to see it earlier, because by the time I went, like a lot for the first time, like a lot of the original vintage Vegas was mostly gone. I think I did walk by the Riviera, which I did a painting of actually, but that's gone now. I think I did see that. And there's a few, I mean, obviously, like vintage, there's a lot of vintage stuff on Fremont, but I think the Tropicana, that was demolished recently. And I think the Flamingo is probably the last vintage casino left on the Strip now. And Circus
Yeah, well,
Circus. Huh.
yeah, I mean, there's the strip and then there's like downtown, which still has a lot of the original like downtown casinos. So the downtown is like the older part of Vegas. And it's almost like actually there's a book Learning from Las Vegas by Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown. And in Casino Labs, like it's like an architectural book. I think it's written in the 70s, but like in Casino Labs, the novel, like the architectural firm Casino Labs sees this book, Learning from Las Vegas, as like their Bible. And they talk about in the novel, or I'm sorry, in Learning from Las Vegas, they talk about how Vegas is like this, it's the epitome of like Western Americana, because in America you have these vast open spaces, and so you need, because you need to signal like the existence of your building or your casino like miles down the road by, if someone's driving up the 15 from LA or something, you need to have this enormous sign. And the enormous sign is much bigger than the little building that the sign kind of refers to. And that this was actually part of a tradition among, like, in the Old West, where they didn't have like the means to, like, if you ever see those Old West like saloons that you see, like, in like, oh, this is our
Oh,
like
yeah.
old ghost town or whatever. The signs, there's the fronts of those buildings are these like, it's just a facade that's like 2 or 3 stories tall, but then you go past that sign into the actual building and it's only one story, so it's just made to look much bigger than it actually is.
Oh, kind of
And
like
it's,
how Disneyland has like the Haunted Mansion is actually in the same with Pirates of the Caribbean, the ride is not actually in the buildings, it's in a sound stage behind it.
right, yeah. I remember the Haunted Mansion. Isn't that like where you feel like you're descending or
Yeah,
something
you
in
go in the
this?
elevator
Are you actually
underground.
descending? Maybe
I
like a
think
little
so.
bit, but not as much as it feels.
I think
It's
you
been a
go
while, but
underground and
I
there's a
love.
tunnel that takes you to a sound stage.
Oh yeah, so that's cool. Now I'm sorry, I'm jumping around a lot, but like back to Baudrillard, he actually makes a connection between Disneyland and Vegas. And speaking of like this idea of the simulacrum, like a lot of people say that like Disneyland and Vegas are these fake experiences that refer to historical things. So like the fairy book castle, the storybook castle, or Disneyland castle refers to like medieval Europe or whatever, just like the Excalibur, the Disneyland castle in Vegas, that refers to, King Arthur, medieval England or whatever. And a lot of people say, yeah, see how the fake has actually replaced the real. But Baudrillard actually takes this one step further. He says, like, no, actually, like, it's called the desert of the real. Americans, and I don't know if I even believe this, but it's basically saying Americans go into this and they actually see that it's fake. They know that it's fake. And by seeing and recognizing that Disneyland and Vegas are fake, they assume that their real lives back home in like New Brunswick or Detroit or Miami, that those are real. That they think, okay, this
Because
Vegas
the
is fake.
suburb,
They're
yeah, I mean, the suburbs are fake. I think the thing about Disneyland is when you go to Europe, you get the otherworldly experience, and like Disneyfication is a pejorative, like used in Europe for areas become too touristy. But I think because American suburbia is so mundane, like we go like the there's like the whole meme, like Disneyland is the only place in SoCal that's actually walkable.
Right. Because it's made to look like a European town or whatever. Yeah, because like I have your friends from Europe who moved to LA who are like, how do you get around? And I'm like, well, Western US, you kind of need a car. I lived in LA for a while, by the way. I actually worked at the Huntington Library. You
Oh,
know
at
it?
the garden, huh?
Yeah, the Huntington. Yeah, they
Oh,
actually have
yeah. Yeah,
a library there.
no, I've been in library too. Very cool. Yeah, I'm a big fan. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. They have like an Ellesmere Chaucer and like all these old, incunabula and stuff. It's
Yeah,
very,
you're
very
just
cool.
like a
It was
curator
really
there
cool
of
work.
sorts.
What's
Yeah.
that?
Were you like a curator there of sorts or like a
Yeah,
librarian or yeah,
I work in,
was
I
that like
was
a yeah.
like, I helped the researchers find their stuff. So I just worked in the library.
Very cool.
It was
Yeah,
like
I've
in
only
reader
been
services.
I've only really been to the library there once, but I remember very much having the impression that there was very active sort of research going
Yeah.
on. You know, it was
Did you
a very active library. Yeah.
have a an English degree or like
I
a
do, yeah.
graduate
Not
degree?
the a bachelor's, not a graduate degree, though.
Okay.
Perhaps I should
Yeah,
have
because you
gotten it. Well,
actually
that's
have
an
to
interesting
prove
question, but
your
yeah.
academic,
Yeah.
you have to like prove academic credentials to get in there. They don't, it's not a public library.
You know what? I may be thinking of a separate room at the Huntington where just some books were
Oh no, that's
shown.
that.
But
But
yeah.
actually, when I worked there, I worked there like with a master's, and I was like behind the desk helping people do like real research, like PhD students
Cool.
and professors.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's what made me want to go do a PhD myself. I'm like, I want to be on your side of the desk. I don't want to be
Yeah.
serving you. I want to be you.
Cool,
And
yeah.
so
Very
I
neat,
went
yeah.
that direction. Anyway. Yeah. So any other
Yeah,
things?
I think before we wrap up, Lee, is there anything else you want to add about Casino Labs or any projects,
Yeah.
anything about the book or any upcoming projects you want to
Oh
plug?
yeah. Okay. Actually I did want to mention Matt,
Yeah.
I really liked your character in Dragon Day, Wallingford. I mean,
Yes.
not that I liked him because he's kind of a
Right.
loathsome person,
Yeah.
but yeah, it was quite captivating. Just the idea of like this person can have like kind of so much authority on, or you know, sway on impressionable young minds.
No, thank you. Yep.
But I, and this is kind of a dumb connection, but one of the first places I lived in my life was Wallingford, Pennsylvania.
Ah,
Do you know
so you
it?
mentioned Philadelphia. I do. So that's very fascinating. You bring this up. The only one who ever has. My family lives in Philadelphia, and it's
Oh,
not so
cool.
much that I named him in Delaware County, which I think is where Wallingford is, right? Near Media.
Yeah.
Very
Media. It's by Media,
specifically,
yeah.
I don't think I named Wallingford after Wallingford, PA, but what I think it
Okay.
was I used to take the SEPTA from the L1 station into Philadelphia, and Wallingford was one of the stops. And I guess I had a touch of train autism or something at that age. I just loved just hearing them shout out the names like Rose Valley, Media, Wallingford. I think it was just in my head, and that's how I came to name Wallingford. But that's interesting you point that out, because that I kind of realized later on, like, must have been from that, like, while I was on the SEPTA again. And lo and behold, and another, this is really apropos of nothing, but I live in LA now, as I think you know, and I drive, when I'm driving down Benedict Canyon, there's something called the Wallingford Estates. I'm not sure what it
Oh.
is, some big house, but yeah, the name has followed me around on various commutes of my life, hauntingly, interestingly.
Yeah, no, I love that kind of old, almost 17th century or 18th century sounding
It's
like
a really good
English.
name. Yeah.
It just sounds so status, you know. But yeah,
Yeah.
I lived there when I was about 6 or 7. Always loved that place, and yeah, it was right next to Swarthmore College,
Right, of course. Yeah.
and
I
actually, you know,
almost
it's funny
went
because like
there
my wife
myself.
and I
So, yeah.
were back. Yeah, you know, I probably could have ended up there too if my
It
parents
was on
didn't
my
move to
list.
Vegas, but my wife and I were back there driving through, and she's from Vegas as well. And we're driving through this beautiful leafy suburb with like ivy covered everything, and it looks very, you know, again, like kind of I don't know,
Is this like by
like
Villanova?
Ivy League
Yes.
colleges or whatever.
What's the
And
place
anyway,
called, like, where Villanova is, like Radnor?
yeah, Radnor. I mean, it's
what's it called?
similar,
Oh yeah, I think I drove.
similar vibe to there. Yeah. I think I drove through it. Like,
Yeah.
it's
But yeah, my wife's
totally a
like,
tangent,
why
but yeah.
did you move to Vegas? This is so
Yeah.
much cooler.
For sure.
But
It's kind of
yeah,
like
I wouldn't be
I
where.
prefer,
Yeah.
for sure. Sorry, I'm not trying
And
to.
I'm like, I would have never met you, my darling wife.
Right, I will vouch for, I mean, not Vegas because I don't live there, but like living in LA, like despite the lack of, like, there's definitely things you get in the suburbs of Philadelphia you don't get here. I like living here. I like the weather. I like a lot of things. And I don't love every element of Philly or every element of the suburbs, but I gotta say, some of those suburbs, Wallingford, Swarthmore, Radnor, like you were saying, Robert, some of those are the most among the most beautiful sort of, I don't want to say among the most beautiful suburb is the wrong word. They're just so, especially from an American perspective, they're just so old and villagey in a way that's really hard to come by.
Well, they are, that is the wrong word. Because the suburbs started actually being, like, suburbs started being a thing, like, after World War II, basically.
Right.
No, anything older than that is, anything older than that is not the same order of suburb yet.
Well, there's, if like, I'm an not, older, like, a streetcar suburb.
Streetcar suburb. Well, that's an L.A. thing more, maybe. I believe it actually literally is called the Village of Swarthmore, so there you go.
Yeah, yeah. There. Actually, it's funny, because my ancestor, Benjamin Scrivener, who emigrated from London in 1729, moved to right outside of Wallingford in Philadelphia and lived there all through, like, Ben Franklin times. He's like a contemporary of Ben Franklin.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So my family history goes pretty far back in that area. Always just.
That's very interesting. Mine does not go back as far in that area, but it does in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a bit further. But anyway, neither here nor there. Robert, if I could be slightly indulgent here, and I actually, it ties into something I wanted to ask you, Lee, before we wrap.
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay, two-pronged question. I'll keep the self-serving Dragon Day question short, other than just the name Wallingford, but then it ties into, you know, your own life and work. I guess, okay, two-pronged question. One, what, as someone who's an English professor, I guess you've already kind of said this, but
No.
Could you sort of, I mean, because you are, and let me just make sure I'm right about this, you are also a pagan, right?
In a way.
Culturally, aesthetically? I just saw something about that online.
I mean, that's an enormously long response that I would have to give, but yeah, sure. I'm a
fair. I'm not okay. Not trying to. I just wanted. To
I'm not one of these like. Yeah. I'm not one of these people who get like extremely passionate in an anti. You know, I don't bash other people's religions or anything like that. But yeah.
Oh yeah, no. I'm
not one of these anti-Christian pagans.
Sure. Yeah. So. No. I'm kind of on a similar wavelength about all of this. All right, two-pronged question. One was, what was in Dragon Age, what was the experience of reading a kind of villainous English professor who has his own pagan elements? Like, what was that experience like? Obviously, you don't necessarily agree with the actions of the character, but did you see yourself at all in that, or not really? Or was it, you know, just comment on that. And then also, like, because I feel like, we don't have to talk about it if it is really long-winded or if it is just something you'd rather not get into, but, you know, we talked a lot today about like kind of tradition and its absence and its kind of reformulation in Vegas and in postmodernism. And have you found some kind of spiritual centering through, you know, inherited kind of pagan aesthetics or tradition?
Oh, wow. So yeah,
those are kind of their own topics.
These are great questions.
we could do a part two. We could do like if it's hard. But
Or we could just we can meet. We could do this again. But I'll give you a bit of an answer now. And if we want to go further down these rabbit holes later, we could do that as well.
For sure. And I'll actually have read
but,
the book.
Yeah. No. So like. Yeah. No. That's why I was so fascinated by that character. And a lot of questions, on one level, I'm not that I would hold this against you. I don't know you at all or your motives or anything, but I'm like, of course you make the bad guy a pagan, but that's kind of a joke, but
no,
like,
fair.
Yeah, no,
that's
fair. I kind of have, not just paganism, but like the Nietzschean, stuff that in him that I recognized, but he was kind of a loathsome person. But I did also recognize that again, like it's a novel and it's quite brilliant actually that you're playing with some of these ideas that you get these ideas articulated by various characters, Toby and Weber Fournier does it too. Like, this is what's beautiful about a novel is that you can bring political ideas, religious ideas into the conversation, and you could do it subtly. You could do it explicitly. You could do it from a lot of different voices. And so you're actually having the political conversation, you're featuring it with, and that's again why I'm sorry. It's like why I get so mad when like agents will be like, "Well, we want this kind of novel." Yeah. Again, that just like it cuts off so many conversations that could one could have, and that also it prescribes various acceptable conversations or unacceptable conversations. Well, we want to admit a lot of different voices from a lot of different perspectives. There can be a Nietzschean, there can be a pagan, there can be a traditionalist, there can be a and there can be the liberal, the neoliberal ideas and or whatever. These yeah. ideas need to have an airing and a place where they meet and clash, and you can kind of think through what our society at large is kind of talking about and thinking about. And if we always like cut off a few of those voices, then we never really get a three-dimensional view of like what our society's actually troubled with, obsessed with, yes. discussing, anyway. I did appreciate Wallingford in that way.
Do you want to plug, Lee, do you want to plug Casino Lab, so where it's available to purchase online, and any other upcoming projects you have?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Are we? Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So I have a Substack, and it's called Scrivener's Pyre, Pyre. And I also have a YouTube channel called Deep Guild. Both the Substack and the YouTube channel I've kind of been neglecting these last few months because I've been traveling a lot. I want to start. Yeah. Getting more. I'm going to be putting a lot more out in the coming weeks. I have a few things kind of in the pike, or
very cool,
the assembly line. So basically that's it. I'm working on a few things, but nothing is like, I have a essay that's about to come out, but I don't have any novels that are like forthcoming in the next few months or whatever, but I do have a few, this was my first novel, and I was like, oh, I want to write another, that was fun. And my son's like, what, you worked so hard on this and now you have to start writing another one? That sounds like a major pain in the ass. And I'm like, no, I want to write more, so we'll see.
Lee Scrivener, great show, thank you so much for being on.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. And if I didn't get to finish the response to Matt, we'll
continue talk. This conversation. Yeah, no, we should. We should
another time. But thank you very much.
And also, thanks, Matt.
Of course. Yes.
Robert, Matt, thank you so much for having me. I had a great time. Thank you very much. And I enjoyed both of your novels, by the way. So yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. Later.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.